Yeah. Make the voice become more clear. Clear more clear. Jungle.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And that's Dr. Lee, PhD, by the Beastie Boys, featuring the legendary producer and musician Lee Scratch Perry, born on this day in 1936. We're about to have a conversation with Johann Hari, whose book is Chasing the Scream, The First and Last Days of the War on Drugs. And as we contemplate and think about the incredible Billie Holiday and her 100th birthday coming up, we are talking to him about that, but also about his book, which is really, the story is really wrapped around that in many ways. And so, Johann, welcome to the Mark Steiner Show. Good to have you with us.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Oh, no, I was looking forward to this. I've followed your work through the years, and you're a great writer, and it's good to, this is a, just an incredible book. And I think that where I'd like to begin is to just really explore what you discovered about addiction, because we've, over these last 22 years on the air, we've covered a lot of stories around heroin addiction, alcoholism, cocaine, everything else, and the plague that runs through the poorest streets in the world, especially here in America, in Latino and black streets of America. But and people always posit these kind of either moralistic arguments or chemical arguments about dependency, and you have really attacked this in a very different way.
Yeah, I mean, I had a very personal reason to want to look into this, because one of my earliest memories is of trying to wake up one of my relatives and not being able to. And as I got older, realizing we had drug addiction in my family and in other people close to me. And I realized that we were coming up to 100 years since drugs were first banned. And I realized also that there were just loads of really basic questions I didn't know the answer to. You know, like, it's odd because I thought I was quite well informed. Obviously, I'd had this issue in my life all my life. And yet I didn't know, why did we go to war against drug users and drug addicts 100 years ago? Why do we carry on when so many people think it doesn't work? What are the alternatives like in practice? And what really causes drug use and drug addiction? And when I tried to look for the answers in books, what I found most of the time was that, like, people write about this question as if they're like a philosophy seminar, and it's a big kind of abstract debate. And I thought, I don't want to do that. I want to go and sit with real people whose lives have been changed one way or another by this question. So I ended up going on this big, long journey across 9 countries and 30,000 miles and just sitting with people and then relating it to the evidence. So people I ended up sitting with were a crazy mixture of people from a transsexual crack dealer in Brownsville, Brooklyn, to a hitman for the deadliest Mexican drug cartel,
right,
to the only country to ever decriminalize all drugs with really incredible effects. But the thing that most shocked me was exactly what you're talking about. In this question, you know, almost everything we think we know about this area is wrong. Drugs aren't what we think they are. Addiction isn't what we think it is. The drug war is not what we've been told it is. And the alternatives aren't what we've been told they are. And particularly about addiction, if you had said to me 4 years ago when I started doing the research on this, what causes, say, heroin addiction, I would have looked at you like you were a little bit simple-minded, and I would have said, well, heroin causes heroin addiction, obviously,
mm-hmm.
because we've been told a story for 100 years that's just become our kind of common sense, right? We think that if you, me, and the next 20 people to walk past your studio, if we all used heroin together for, say, 20 days, on day 21, we'd all be heroin addicts, because there are chemical hooks in heroin, and our body would start to physically need the drug, and that's what addiction is. And the first thing that alerted me to the fact there might be something wrong with that story is when it's explained to me, if you step out of this interview when we finish speaking and, God forbid, you're hit by a truck and you break your hip, you'll be taken to hospital, you'll be given a lot of diamorphine. Diamorphine is heroin. It's much better heroin than you would score on the streets in Baltimore or anywhere else, because it's not got any of the contaminants that get into it when, you know, it's sold by drug dealers, right? Anyone listening to this, there are people near you being given a lot of heroin totally legally in hospitals near you. If what we think about addiction is right, what should happen? Those people should get the same chemical hooks as a recreational user. They should become addicts. You will have noticed that doesn't happen. There are studies of this, very detailed studies. It doesn't happen. Your grandmother was not turned into a junkie by her hip operation, right? I didn't really know when I learned that. I thought, oh, that's so weird. I don't know what to do with that. until I went and interviewed a guy called Bruce Alexander, who's a professor in Vancouver, who I think has really transformed how we understand this field. Bruce explained to me the theory of addiction that we have, the kind of common sense one that you, me, and I'm guessing pretty much everyone listening to this has, comes from a series of experiments that were done earlier in the 20th century. They're really simple experiments. Your listeners can do them at home if they're feeling a bit sadistic. You get a rat and you put it in a cage and you give it two water bottles. And one is just water and one is water laced with either heroin or cocaine.
Of course, you get arrested for doing that because you had the heroin and cocaine.
Yeah, I don't want to get your... just in case your listeners are taking me too literally, don't do that, you will go to prison. Write to me from prison, I'll write a moving book about your plight. If you do that, if you put the rat in a cage with these two bottles, the rat will almost always prefer the drugged water and almost always kill itself. So there you go. That's our theory of addiction, right? You might remember there was a famous advert, a kind of Partnership for a Drug-Free America advert that used this experiment in the 80s. In the 70s, though, Bruce comes along and says, hang on a minute, we're putting the rat in an empty cage. It's got nothing to do except to use these drugs. Let's do this differently. So Professor Alexander built Rat Park. It's a completely different cage, and it's basically heaven for rats, right? Anything a rat could want in life, it's got in this cage. It's got really nice food, it's got tunnels, it's got coloured balls, but crucially it's got loads of friends, it can have loads of sex, and it's got both the water bottles, the normal water and the drugged water. But here's the fascinating thing. In Rat Park, the rats don't like the drugged water.
Mm-hmm.
They hardly use any of it. They never use it in a way that looks compulsive. They never overdose. Now, there's a really important human example that's happening at the same time. I'll come to it in a minute. But what Bruce says is, if you'd like me to, what Bruce says is, this shows that both the right-wing and left-wing theories of addiction are not right. The right-wing theory is it's a kind of, you know, moral failing. You're a hedonist, you indulge yourself, you should be ashamed, all of that. The left-wing theory is your brain gets hijacked, you get taken over. What Bruce says is it's not your morality and it's not your brain. To a much larger degree than we've appreciated, addiction is an adaptation to your environment. It's your cage. And you can see that one way that helped me to think about this differently is there's a guy called Peter Cohen, who's a professor in Amsterdam, who talks about how we shouldn't use the word addiction, we should use the word bonding. Human beings have an innate need to bond. And when we're happy and healthy, we'll bond with the people around us. But when we can't do that, because we're traumatized or isolated or just beaten down by life, we'll bond with something that gives us some sense of relief. Now, that might be gambling, that might be pornography, that might be crack, but you will bond with something that gives you a sense of relief, because that's what we have to do, because we're humans and we need to bond.
And I think there's some really interesting pieces of this that I think they're so important to kind of tease out. I mean, one of the things is around the Vietnam War that you also write about, and that any of us from that era know that, you know, that all the heroin that was in Vietnam and heroin addiction and what happened there. But this really speaks to both environment and in some larger sense, the environment of war, but the larger sense of the kind of chaotic, intense, harried world that modern capitalism has created, and how that ties into addiction. I don't care what class you are, wealthy or poor.
That's really important. Just to start with Vietnam, I think you put it really well. To start with Vietnam, 20% of American troops in Vietnam were using heroin regularly. And if you look at the reports from the time, there was a real panic because they believed the old theory of addiction. And so totally understandably, they thought, my God, we're going to have hundreds of thousands of junkies on the streets of the US when the war's over. Actually, there was a very detailed study of this. What happened is the soldiers came home. They didn't go to rehab. They didn't get any treatment. 95% of them just stopped. They just stopped taking heroin. Because that's impossible to explain if you believe the old theory of addiction. But if you understand Bruce Alexander's theory of addiction, it makes total sense. If you're taken out of a hellish, pestilential jungle where you don't want to be, you could be killed at any moment, and it's a nightmare, and you go back to your nice life in Wichita, Kansas, with your friends and your family in your job, it's the equivalent of being taken out of that first cage and being put into Rat Park. Your environment radically changes, and so you can bear to be present in your life. The way I would explain this to people so it's so easy to understand is, like, while I'm talking to you, I've got a bottle of Diet Pepsi here. You've probably got a drink in front of you, right?
I have iced coffee and a glass of water, both.
Delicious. And you and I totally forget the drug laws. You and I, totally legally, we could in fact have in front of us vodka, right? We could actually legally have in front of us absinthe,
right,
if we wanted, right?
Right.
We don't. The reason why we don't isn't because anyone's stopping us. The reason why we don't is because we've got something we want to be present for in our lives. We've got jobs we love. We've got people we want to talk to. We've got people we love. We've got things we want to be there for. And I think a really important thing to understand about addiction is that it's about not being present in your life. And that's true, by the way, not just of drug addiction. If you, like, I've got someone close to me who's a gambling addict, and when you look at a gambling addict when they're gambling, it's about being out. It's not a pleasure. It's about being out of your head. It's about being out of yourself. It's about being totally enveloped in this other thing. And I think you disclose exactly what you're saying about the way modern capitalism works. You know, we've created a world where for a lot of people, life looks more like that first cage and less like Rat Park.
Mm-hmm.
Bruce Alexander, who did the Rat Park experiment, talks a lot about, you know, in addiction, we talk almost all the time about individual recovery, and that's got real value. But we need to talk much more about social recovery. Something's gone wrong with us, not just as individuals, but as a group. And there's loads of those things. Partly we have freakishly isolated societies. There's a writer called George Monbiot who calls this the age of loneliness. There is no human society ever before where you've had people cut off and isolated like they are here, but like they are in our cultures. But also, you know, the nature of the kind of consumer capitalism we're raised in, I think, is really important to this, because what we're taught from the moment we're born, we're bombarded with advertising that tells us the solution to our problems and our dreams is to buy something and consume it and you take it into yourself. If you don't have that attitude, you are not a good citizen of our societies, right? You're not doing your job.
Right.
Well, I think in some ways addiction is, I wouldn't say this is all of addiction by any means, but there's an element of it where actually it's taking the kind of extreme logic of our culture, which is consume, 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 the solution lies in buying something, using it, discarding it. Actually, addiction is to some degree the kind of hypercharged process that we're all raised with. There's some people like Dr. Gabor Mate who said, you know, we've created these addiction-generating environments to a degree more than would be kind of normal for human beings.
And I think this is a really important piece, and it adds so much to the conversations we have about what's really happening around us and what programs work and why they work. And I want to your example is so interesting that Bruce Alexander happens to be in Vancouver, which is a piece of your story as well on another level. But let me, before we even get there, let me talk about to me, which I think would be fascinating for our listeners, because we are here at the radio station from which we broadcast. We're a talk station. We're also a jazz station. And so and we'll be doing this piece celebrating the birthday of Billie Holiday coming up. And she forms a core of this book in so many ways. It is like she is the I mean, the way you portray her, I mean, she's emblematic of the modern condition and of what happens in the black world in the diaspora. But she's also the way you portray it, I mean, and portray her as this deeply intelligent woman as well that has a lot to say to us. So I'm going to get to that story. And I don't know if you want to begin there or if you want to begin with the kind of anti-hero, Harry Anslinger. But Anslinger, excuse me. But
that's a Freudian slip, yeah.
It was, wasn't it?
I'm with you on that one. I think you're right. I think Billie Holiday is an absolutely... Okay, everyone listening to this knows that Billie Holiday was an extraordinary jazz singer. I think one of the things that I found from speaking to, tracking down everyone who was still alive who knew her and going through the archives... and putting together the story of how she was stalked and killed by the founder of the war on drugs really made me admire her on a whole other level as well that I hadn't known about before. In 1939, Billie Holiday stood on stage in New York City, and she sang the song Strange Fruit, which all your listeners know is a song against lynching. Her goddaughter, Lorraine Feather, said to me, you've got to understand how shocking it was to have an African-American woman standing up in front of a white audience in a hotel where she wasn't even allowed to walk through the front door. She had to go through the service elevator and singing a song against lynching at a time when almost all pop songs were like P.S. I Love You kind of twee things, right? And that night, according to her biographer, Julia Blackburn, Billie Holiday gets a warning from the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, and they effectively say to her, stop singing this song. the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, it might sound really weird, why would the Bureau of Narcotics be telling people what songs to sing? And it's really important to understand the wider context because it helps us to understand why the drug war started and how it works today. The Federal Bureau of Narcotics was run by a man called Harry Anslinger, who was the most influential person who no one's ever heard of. He took over the Department of Prohibition just as alcohol prohibition is ending. So he's got this huge big government bureaucracy that he wants to keep intact and nothing for it to do. And he invents the modern war on drugs as the purpose for his department. Way before Nixon, way before Reagan, right back then in the early 30s, he's the first person to use the phrase warfare against drugs. And he's really driven by two intense hatreds, a hatred of addicts and a hatred of African-Americans. Yep. And it's important to understand, he was regarded as a crazy racist by the crazy racists in the 1930s, right? He used the N-word so often in official memos that his own senator said he should have to resign in the 30s. And he became, it was fascinating looking at his writing and going through his archives, he was obsessed with Billie Holiday and with jazz. To him, Billie Holiday was like a symbol of everything that had gone wrong with America. She was, well, she's an African-American woman standing up to white supremacy for a start. But he thought jazz was like a symbol of total disorder and chaos. He thought it was, it's hilarious, these memos in his, go through the memos in his archives and get things like his agents would be sent to like Harlem to write down the lyrics of what jazz singers were singing, and they'd write these down and they'd sing like, you know, they'd quote a song going, when he gets the notion, he thinks he can walk across the ocean, and Anslinger would write, they really do believe that with their marijuana cigarettes, you know. So he believed that you could only... you could only listen to jazz if you were unhinged, deranged, and on drugs. And he ordered his agents to really order a roundup of jazz singers generally, because, you know, drug use was pretty rife. But what's fascinating is no one would snitch in the jazz world, so it was very hard to get anyone to inform, except Billie Holiday was very unlucky. She had this scumbag pimp husband who did meet with Anslinger and did inform on him. But just to go back to that opening moment, because it's so important, when Billie Holiday gets told to stop singing Strange Fruit, she, you know, she had grown up in Baltimore when it was. She actually grew up in a place that was known as Pigtown in Baltimore, which gives you some idea.
Southwest side of town, right?
Exactly. It's the, right. It was the last city when it was the last city in the United States that didn't even have a sewage system, and she had. She was. There were loads of stores she wasn't allowed in because she was an African American, and she promised herself as a little girl that she would never bow her head to any white man. So when she gets this warning from Anslinger's men, she basically says, "Screw you! I'm going to sing my song." And that's the point at which they resolve to destroy her. It's worth also remembering, at the same time, Harry Anslinger finds out there are two other famous people in America who are heroin addicts, Judy Garland and Joe McCarthy. He responds a little bit differently. With Judy Garland, Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz, he tells her to take slightly longer vacations and reassures the studio she's going to be fine. With Joe McCarthy, he arranges for him to be given a regular prescription of opiates from a pharmacist in Washington, D.C., with Billie Holiday, who you might notice is the only African-American in this list, with Billie Holiday, he has her stalked to her deathbed. The first person he sends to stalk her is a guy called Jimmy Fletcher. Yeah. Anslinger hated employing African-Americans, but you couldn't really send a white guy into Harlem to stalk Billie Holiday. It'd be kind of obvious. So he employs Jimmy Fletcher, and Jimmy Fletcher spends 2 years following Billie Holiday everywhere she goes. And because Billie Holiday was so amazing, Jimmy Fletcher fell in love with her. And his whole life, he felt ashamed of what he did. He busts her. She's put on trial. She said the trial was called the United States versus Billie Holiday, and that's how it felt. She goes to prison. She doesn't sing. She's sent made to clear out pigsties. And in prison, she doesn't sing a word. But the cruelest thing is what happens next. She gets out of prison, and you needed a license to perform anywhere. The alcohol was served, and they wouldn't give her the license. Her friend Yolanda Bavan, who's also a great jazz singer, said to me, you know, what's the cruelest thing you can do to a person is to take away the thing they love. And what they did is they take away singing from Billie Holiday. She always found somewhere she could perform. She would always go somewhere, but it was really hard. And, of course, in that situation, and this is, by the way, what we do to addicts all over America and all over Britain. We cut them off. We give them criminal records where we make it very hard for them to ever work again. And she, of course, in that situation, she relapses. She'd had an extremely hard life. She was prostituted as a child. You know, she was raped and prostituted as a child. She was trying to stun her pain with heroin and alcohol. And in her early 40s, she collapses in Manhattan. And she's taken to hospital. The first hospital won't even take her in because she's an addict. Second hospital, she says to one of her friends, she's convinced that Anslinger's men aren't finished with her. And she says to one of her friends, they're going to kill me in there. Don't let them, they're going to kill me. She's taken into the hospital and she's diagnosed with liver cancer. And I interviewed the last surviving person, an amazing man called Eugene Callender, who was in the room, that room with her. They arrested her on her deathbed. They handcuffed her to her deathbed. They didn't let her friends in to see her. They took away her candies and her record player. They, one of her friends, Maylie Dufty, managed to insist that she was given methadone because she'd obviously gone into heroin withdrawal because she wasn't being given any in the hospital. She actually started to recover over 10 days when she was given methadone. Then the agents cut it off, and a few days later she died. One of her friends said to the BBC she looked like she had been violently wrenched from life. Mm. And I think there's loads of things we can take from that. One is we understand what the drug war is about right from the start. The drug war is overwhelmingly founded in a race panic. You know, when we think about why drugs were banned, we tend to assume that people then gave the reasons we would give now, right? That, you know, you don't want kids to use drugs, you don't want people to become addicted. That stuff barely comes up. I went through the debates and the files. That stuff barely comes up. Overwhelmingly, there was a crazy belief that African Americans and Chinese Americans were taking drugs, forgetting their place, and attacking white people. And these drugs had to be banned and eradicated so that African Americans and Chinese Americans would kind of go back into their place. Now, of course, you and I understand that, you know, the failure of Reconstruction after the Civil War, African Americans and Chinese Americans are treated appallingly. They were angry. Actually, it's amazing how little they were rebelling, given how appallingly they were treated. That's the real reason why they were rebelling. But you can see that white Americans, particularly crazed white supremacists like Harry Anslinger, didn't want to see that. So partly it's about race. This continues right through to today. African Americans are no more likely to be drug dealers or drug users than anyone, any other ethnic group, and yet they make up the overwhelming majority of people who go to prison for it. Also, you see the dynamics with addicts in a destructive way, in that what we do is we make addicts worse, right? We take them, we punish, we take people who are addicts because they're cut off and in pain, and we cut them off and impose more pain on them, and we're surprised they don't stop. But also there's something that I took much more positive from this. Anyone who's got addicts in their life, like I do, people they love, if we're honest, a lot of the time you feel angry with them. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very difficult. We all have a Harry Anslinger inside us, and we all have a bit of us that looks at the addicts we know and thinks, I wish someone would just stop you. And one of the things that really helped me was to know, to look at someone like Billie Holiday and some of the other people I met, and to know that addicts can be heroes, to know that, you know, the most amazing thing to me about Billie Holiday, no matter what they did to her, she never stopped singing that song.
Right.
She would go to the South. She would go to places where they would try to kill her with bottles, and she sang her song against lynching. And while we're talking, all over the world, there are people listening to Billie Holiday and feeling stronger. And what an amazing achievement for a woman who was in such pain and had been through so much. And to know that addicts can be heroic, I think actually the story of Billie Holiday and what was done to her is a story about how the drug war begins, but also the courage and resistance of Billie Holiday should help us to tell a story about how the drug war will end as well. And I think that's as important. Her friend Annie Ross, who's another brilliant jazz singer, said to me that Billie Holiday wasn't weak. Billie Holiday was as strong as she could be. And that's how I like to think of her, as someone who is as strong as she could be. I think that's really important.
There's so much here. To conclude a bit with Billie Holiday, several things have popped out as I was reading your work. In that, as I said earlier, I thought she is emblematic of everything about the war on drugs, about the attack on people of color, how they really just went after her and literally were the cause of her death, that of so many other people out here, and that she was also. I've had a number of friends, a lot of people in my life who have been addicted, and people I've been very close to have been addicted to heroin, And one of my friends made me think of this, was a man who I helped him pass away, but he was, and he had finally, we helped him finally kick heroin. It took a while, but at any rate, for 20 odd years, this guy fired his dope every day, and he was IBM's top international troubleshooter. He went in all over the world to fix computer glitches in major companies, taking his works and his heroin with him. And part of it was this myth of the addiction in some ways, you know, reminding me of her and what she went through and how she kept on going. I mean, it's a horrible addiction, but we have a whole misconception of what it's about.
I think that's really important. And actually, we have a wider misconception about drug use itself. And again, this is something that kind of surprised me, how stark the figures are. That if I said to your average guy on the street, and I would ask listeners, you know, to think of a number when I say this, what proportion of drug use that's currently banned do you think doesn't cause any problems to anyone? So doesn't lead to any health problems, doesn't lead to addiction. You know, if you just had to think of a number, what proportion of people who use illegal drugs don't have any problem with them at all? Health, addiction, any problem. The UN Office of Drug Control is the main drug war body in the world, right? Mm-hmm. They are the exact opposite side of the debate to me. They said that this is not a liberal's figure, right? This is their figure. Is that 90%, 90% of all currently illegal drug use is non-problematic. That's kind of amazing. And partly it's because, exactly what you're saying, we get a very distorted picture of drug use. Because if I said to you, picture an alcohol drinker, right? You would picture a bar on a Saturday night. You would picture people drinking beer and wine. You would, you know, you don't picture a homeless alcoholic drinking, like, methylated spirits in the gutter, right? Because even though we all know that alcoholism exists and is a horrific tragedy, we know that it's a small part of overall alcohol use and that those alcoholics had terrible problems before they found the alcohol, and, you know, it's not like one day they were just kind of hijacked by alcohol. But part of the problem with the drug war is that it creates a distorted picture of other drugs, because you would be a very because we don't see or hear about the people like your friend or the you know, the unharmed drug user. You might well, you know, do a Facebook status update where you say, I had a great bottle of wine last night. You'd be pretty foolish if you did a Facebook status update saying I had a great line of coke last night.
Right.
You know, because, you know, like, right. Someone might ring the cops, you might lose your job. It's just a bad idea. Everyone listening to this knows why that's a bad idea, right? So we end up with a really distorted picture where the only people who are in our minds for drug use are, for illegal drug use, are the people with a problem. Now, those people with a problem are real, and they desperately need our help, not our stigma and punishment. But they are, it's really important, what you're saying is really important to remind people that actually they're a really small part of overall drug use.
I'm talking to Johan Hari, author of Chasing the Scream, The First and Last Days of the American Drug War. We have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. When we come back, we'll hear the rest of my interview with Johan Hari. And on our way to break, we're hearing Stray Cat Strut by the Stray Cats. Slim Jim Phantom of the Stray Cats, born on this day in 1961.
Ain't got enough dough to pay the rent.
From school funding to testing, you can learn about the important issues that impact Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org.
Get a shoe thrown at me from a mean old man. Get my dinner from a garbage can.
Babylon is falling. Babylon is falling. It was foolish to build it on the sand.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner here on The Mark Steiner Show, on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. That's Handsworth Revolution by Steel Pulse. Fonzo Martin of Steel Pulse, born on this day in 1956. I'm speaking with Johan Hari, author of Chasing the Scream, The First and Last Days of the American Drug War. But just to conclude, I mean, because then you took us through, in your book, through Mexico and Vancouver, and but this amazing journey, I think, through Portugal, and Vancouver, especially those two places, and what they taught you and what they can teach the rest of us about if we can be bold enough politically in our own worlds to do something different?
Well, Vancouver, one of the most amazing people I've ever known in my life was someone I got to know in Vancouver. In the year 2000, it's very related to Billie Holiday, I think. In the year 2000, there was a homeless street addict in Vancouver on the downtown east side of Vancouver, which is a notorious place, the highest concentration of addicts anywhere in North America, quite possibly the world.
That's amazing. I never knew that until now, but yeah.
Yeah, it's a fascinating place. And this homeless street addict was called Bud Osborne. And he was watching his friends die all around him. Because what happened is people would shoot up behind dumpsters so that the cops wouldn't see them. But obviously, if you're hidden, no one can see you. If you start to overdose, like, no one can help you. You just your body gets found days later. And Bud just thought to himself, look, I can't just watch this happen, right? I can't just watch all my friends die. But at the same time, he thought, what can I do? I'm a homeless junkie. And Bud had a really simple idea. He got together a group of the addicts. And he just said, no one official, just us, why don't we do something really simple? Why don't we, when we're not using, which even for hardcore addicts is most of the time, have a timetable and we'll just patrol the alleyways and look behind the dumpsters, and if we spot someone ODing, we'll call an ambulance. Really simple idea. So they started to do it, the addicts, not with any, like, nurses or cops or anything. And within a few months, the overdose rate started to really significantly fall on the downtown east side, which was obviously like a great thing in itself. It means people were living who would otherwise have died. But it also meant that the addicts started to think about themselves differently. They started to think, oh, maybe we're not the pieces of rubbish that we think we are. You know, maybe we can do something. And they started to turn up at the public meetings for to discuss the menace of the addicts. And they would sit at the back, and halfway through, Bud would put up his hand and he'd say something like, oh, I think you're talking about us. Is there anything we could do differently? And sometimes people would be really angry, and sometimes they'd be, they'd say things like, oh, you leave your needles lying around. And Bud said, that's fine, we'll extend the patrols, we'll pick up the needles. And Bud started to do a load of research, and he discovered that in Frankfurt, in Germany, they had opened safe injecting rooms where addicts could go and use their drugs and be monitored by doctors, and deaths by overdose had virtually ended in Frankfurt. And he said, great, we've got to have that here. But there had been nothing like that in North America since Anslinger shut it all down. But they thought, well, we'll fight for it, we'll campaign for it. And by this time, there's a really big, active group of drug addicts, their friends, and what they decided to do, and their supporters, what they decided to do was they started stalking the mayor of Vancouver. It was a guy called Philip Owen. Philip Owen was a right-wing businessman from a rich family who had said that all addicts should be taken and detained at the local military base and never let out. If you picture Mitt Romney, you've got some idea of where he was in the spectrum. And they started just stalking Philip Owen. Anywhere he turned up in public, they would turn up, and they had a coffin with them. And the coffin said something like, who will die next, Philip Owen, before you open a safe injecting room? And they kept going to public meetings, and quite often at the public meetings they'd say, you remember the person who asked you a few months ago when you'd open a safe injecting room? Well, she's dead now because you didn't open a safe injecting room. And 2 years pass, and they're getting a bit disheartened because, nothing changes. And one day, to his eternal credit, Philip Owen looks at them and just says, thinks to himself, who the hell are these people? And completely incognito, he goes to the downtown east side and he just talks to a load of addicts. And he's totally blown away. He had no idea. He's amazed by how much pain they're in and how brave they are. And Philip Owen does a load of reading and research about the drug war. And he holds a press conference. And he has the chief of police, the coroner, and a representative of the addicts. And he says he's never going to speak about addiction again without an addict present. And he announces they're going to open the first safe injecting room in North America since the 1930s, and they're going to have the most compassionate drug policies in North America. And the drug room, the safe injecting room, opens. And Philip Owen's right-wing party is so appalled they deselect him as their candidate, and his political career ends. But then their party is beaten by the rival party to the left, and the injecting room is kept open. And when I went to the downtown east side, it was 10 years since the injecting room had opened, and the results were in. Deaths by overdose were down by 80%, 80%, and average life expectancy on the downtown east side had increased by 10 years, which is, like, you don't get figures like that except when a war ends, which is what this was. And Philip Owen told me that it was the proudest thing he ever did, and he would do the hot, he would do it all again, even though he would sacrifice his political career all over again. You know, how many times as a politician do you get to save that many people's lives? And Bud, after I got to know him, and people can actually listen to my interviews with him on the website chasingthescream.com, Bud died last year. He was only in his early 60s, but he, you know, he had been a homeless street addict during a drug war, and it takes a toll on you. And when he died, they sealed off the streets of the downtown east side where he had lived as a homeless person. And they had this incredible memorial service. And there were loads of people in that room, in that crowd, who knew that they were alive because of what Bud had started. And what I would say to anyone listening to this who thinks, like, the drug war is an atrocious thing, but it's so big, what can we do? You know, you are so much more powerful than you think. Bud Osborne was a homeless street addict. It's hard to think of a more disempowered person in our culture. He didn't wait for a leader. He didn't wait for someone else to do it. He just started. And because of what Bud did, he transformed Vancouver and transformed Canada. The Canadian Supreme Court, as a direct result of that activism, has ruled that addicts have an inalienable right to life, and that includes a safe place to use drugs. That will never be taken away now. If he could do it, we can do it.
And I think that the examples that you give of what the incredible example of Portugal, which people raise but don't talk about in as in depth as you did, or your conversations with President Mujica of Uruguay and legalization of marijuana, which is different than Portugal where they didn't criminalize, but it came close. But how it just transforms the nature of society and how you can – I think I have this right from your book that in Portugal they took all the money that they would have used on the drug war – and instead used it for addiction and creating a better society to help people. Am I right about that?
Yeah, it's fascinating how it happened. In the year 2000, Portugal had one of the worst drug problems in Europe. 1% of the population was addicted to heroin, which is kind of mind-blowing. And every year they had tried the American way more and more. So they'd arrested more people, imprisoned more people, and every year the problem got worse. And one day the Prime Minister and the leader of the opposition got together and basically said, look, we can't go on like this, right? We can't have, you know, an ever-rising proportion of our population addicted to heroin. And they agreed. What they said that they'd do is they'd set up a scientific panel of doctors and judges to genuinely figure out what would solve the problem. But they did a really smart thing. They agreed in advance that they would abide by whatever the panel recommended, so it just took it out of politics. So the panel goes away, it looks at all the best evidence in the world, and it comes back, I think, a year and a half later. And they said, decriminalize all drugs, from cannabis to crack, everything. But, and this is the crucial next step, take all the money we currently spend on arresting and imprisoning drug users and spend all that money instead on reconnecting drug addicts with society. So partly that's, things like rehab and psychological support, which have real value. But much more, it's actually something much more basic and the exact opposite of what we do. It was about making sure that every addict in Portugal had something to wake up for in the morning. So it was about subsidized jobs for addicts and microloans for addicts to set up small businesses. So I'll give you an example. Say you used to be a mechanic. When you're ready, they'll go to a garage and they'll say, if you employ Mark for a year, we'll pay half his wages. So just massively incentivize people to employ addicts. And, you know, the results are in, and they're kind of amazing. It's been nearly 15 years. Injecting drug use is down by 50% in Portugal, 50%. Overall addiction is down. Overdose deaths are massively down. HIV transmission is massively down. And one of the ways you know this has worked really well is I went and interviewed this guy called Joao Figueira, who was the top drug cop in Portugal.
Right.
And yeah, exactly. And he led the opposition to the decriminalisation. And he said what a lot of people listening to this will be thinking, totally reasonably, which is, surely if you decriminalise all drugs, you'll have all sorts of problems in your society. And he said to me, everything I said would happen didn't happen, and everything the other side said would happen did. And he talked about how he was ashamed, having seen how decriminalization works, that he'd spent 20 years arresting and harassing drug addicts, and he hoped the whole world followed Portugal's example. It really struck me. I went to several places that have moved beyond the drug war in one way or another, and it really struck me, nowhere regrets it. You know, like, it was hard to find people who wanted to go back. You can see this in the US, you know, Colorado and Washington voted to legalize marijuana by 53%. Look at the polling now in those states. Much higher percentages support keeping it legal. Once people see in practice what the alternatives to the drug war mean, they see that it's not the kind of caricature, it's not a free-for-all, it's not, you know, it's not everyone taking drugs or saying that taking drugs is a good thing. Once they see that that's the reality of the alternative, very few people want to go back.
But this is, you've written, I think, is a really important book in this conversation about where what we do in this war on drugs. And I love the idea that the first and last day of the war on drugs, I hope the last days are correct.
Me too.
I really do. And I think that you've given us ammunition here for those of us who talk about this a lot to work with. And I also think it's incredibly interesting that when I first got the book in the mail and saw two people who I know who loved your book, Len Greenwald and Naomi Klein, I said, this has got to be good, and I'm glad we got this. But I looked at the title, Chasing the Scream, and I had all kinds of notions of what you meant by that, but I had no idea the kind of what's the word I'm looking for? That coming up with a title that the protagonist, that the anti-hero uttered, as opposed to kind of being something that, and you turned it into something different. I just tell a little bit of that story. I love that.
Oh yeah, this is the story about Harry Anslinger, and as I was saying before, the kind of founder of the modern drug war. When he was a little boy, because as we said, he was driven by these two hatreds: hatred of addicts, hatred of African Americans. When he was a little boy, he grew up in a place called Altoona in Pennsylvania, quite rural. And there was a farmer who lived near him. And one day, I think he was 10 or 11, he went to this farmhouse, and the farmer's wife was screaming, and he didn't understand why. And the farmer said to him, go to the pharmacy and pick up this prescription, which we now know would have been opiates, like heroin, which was, of course, legal then. And so Harry Anslinger gets into this horse and cart, and he kind of whips the horse, and he gets there as quickly as he can. He gets the prescription, he goes back. The farmer gives the drugs to his wife. His wife calms down, and that's that. Except Harry Anslinger has haunted his whole life by his memory of these screams, and he becomes kind of obsessed with this memory. And the book is called Chasing the Scream, partly because I think in a way Harry Anslinger's kind of chasing that scream across America and across the world. And the tragedy of Harry Anslinger is he thinks he's quieting those screams. In fact, he's creating a whole load of other screams in his wake and a whole series of disasters. And he doesn't realize it. You know, there's this, and it's not like people didn't point it out to him. You know, like, it's one of the fascinating things about looking at the early drug war is how massively contested it was. You know, huge numbers of people fight back against the introduction of the drug war. It doesn't come in easily. Anslinger has to have 17,000 doctors arrested in the United States because they resist this policy to the point where they carry on giving drugs to addicts.
Who ever heard of that before?
It's fascinating, isn't it?
The
mayor of Los Angeles stands in front of a heroin prescribing clinic right at the start in the 30s and says, you know, words to the effect of, you will not shut down this clinic. You know, this does a good job for the people of L.A. And he, you know, it's a popularly elected politician. This is a huge and important part of American history that's just been kind of, you know, thrown down the memory hole, but is really important.
So let me just conclude with this, if we might, Johan. Where do you finish the book? You've been interviewed by lots of people across the globe now, and you've had 5 years writing this book, more, whatever that number is. So where do you think it takes us now? I mean, where do you think we are now? All of this, because, you know, I live in a city here that I grew up in and left for a long time, but came back. I live in a city here that has a huge addiction rate. It's massive, the numbers of people here that are addicted, and now people are paying attention to Baltimore only because white people are dying, and they're finally realizing that their children are also addicted. in the counties and the suburbs. But I so what do you think this takes? Where do you think we're going to go with this argument now? Because there's so much vested in the prison system locking people up. There's so much vested in addiction, and there's so much capital invested in all that, and how you turn that around and where you think we really are.
You know, it's totally up to us now. And it depends on what we do and whether we organize and demand it, and there's a big enough movement of citizens to overwhelm the incredibly strong vested interests in keeping the drug war going. But, you know, the thing that helps me think about it, apart from Bud's story and some of the other people who've resisted this, is to think about, you know, in 1969, a bunch of drag queens start a riot, 20 drag queens start a riot in New York City. After 2,000 years of gay people being relentlessly persecuted, they say, you know what, you're not going to treat us like this anymore. And it's worth remembering, the pro-gay position in 1969 was to say gay people aren't evil, they're just sick, they're diseased, right? That was the pro-gay position, and not many people held that, right? Those people who started that riot, it wouldn't even have occurred to them to ask for gay marriage. It would have seemed like ridiculous. It'd be like you and me saying we wanted to live on Mars and smoke crack there, right? Like, it would just seem ridiculous, right? And yet, some of those people lived to see the day when an African-American president in his second inaugural names that riot as one of the greatest moments in American history, and it gets the biggest cheer of the whole inaugural. If you had told them that, they would have thought you were, they would have thought you were smoking crack if crack had existed, right? It would have seemed ludicrous. So I would say to people is that things can change in unimaginable ways if people band together and they organize and they appeal to the decency of ordinary Americans. Because what happened? Like, the gay people didn't go and blow anything up. They didn't kill anyone. You know, what they did is they banded together and lots of brave people came out and lots of brave people and loads of really good and decent heterosexual people were like, oh yeah, you're people like us. We love you, you know. And that is the model for how we're going to change this. We need to have, it's absolutely not about a movement that's pro-drugs or saying people, you know, like, I don't drink alcohol, right? I like 3 glasses of wine a year or something. I just don't like alcohol, right? No one would think it was weird. I don't like alcohol, and I'm against alcohol prohibition, right? In the same way, anyone listening to this who hates drugs, like, people who use cocaine are exceptionally irritating, right? For example, right? I agree with that. You don't have, one of the things that is very important is we have to have a movement that is not asking anyone to like drug use, to endorse drug use, to want to use drugs. It's about saying, do we want to carry on with a system that, A, makes addicts worse, B, transfers one of the biggest industries in America to armed criminal gangs who commit an extraordinary amount of violence. Where are the violent alcohol dealers today? They don't exist. The drinks aisle at Walmart does not go and shoot the local liquor store's owner in the face, right? That did happen under alcohol prohibition. An enormous amount of the violence that people unconsciously or consciously associate with drugs, nothing to do with drugs. It's to do with the drug war. It's to do with drug prohibition. If we banned milk and people still wanted to use milk, there would be a massive and violent milk market, right? We've created an enormous amount of violence. We are wasting your tax money enormously. We've created an extraordinary, I'll give you one stat about the American prison system. The United States imprisons more people than any human society ever has as a proportion of its population. And rape is so endemic in that prison system that the United States today is almost certainly the first society ever where more men have been raped than women. You know, I went out with a chain gang of women who were these broken, brave women who had drug addiction problems, who were forced to go out on a chain gang wearing T-shirts saying, I was a drug addict, and dig graves. You know, that's the reality. Okay, that's the sharpest edge of the spear, but frankly, the American prison system is a lot closer to that than anything like the compassionate model I saw in Portugal. So we make addicts worse. We relentlessly abuse people's civil liberties in shocking ways that I tell about in the book. It's a massively racist war. You know, I quote in the book a guy, and even when, so a lot of it is, tell the story of a cop called Lee Maddox.
Yes, go ahead. Yeah. You do that.
Yeah, an incredible woman. She was a cop in Baltimore. She could not have been more motivated to fight the drug war. She signed up because her best friend was murdered by what she believed was a drug gang. And for years, Lee Maddox is like Harry Anslinger's dream girl. She busts people just for having a joint. And, you know, she really goes after them. But what Lee Maddox is an honest person, and she noticed two things. One is they were overwhelmingly busting African-Americans, and Lee isn't a racist. You know, I quote in the book someone who Lee later got to know, another cop called Matthew Fogg, who said, I'm paraphrasing, it's not his exact words, but he went to his boss one day and said, "Hey, boss, why do we only ever go to black neighborhoods when we're doing drug busts? I'm pretty sure white people use drugs." And his boss said something like, you know, "Well, you're damn right they do, but white people get lawyers and they know judges and journalists. So, you know, we'll go for the low-hanging fruit." So even when the cops, what Lee realized is even when the cops aren't consciously racist, the effect is racist, because you can't enforce a law that's broken by half of the population, which drug laws have been. Obviously, you can't put half of the United States in prison, right? What are you going to do? You're going to go after the people who are easiest to bust, most likely to be convicted in a racist criminal justice system, and so on. But Lee noticed another thing, which is even more striking. If you're a cop and you bust, I know, a rapist, the next week there's less rape in your town, right? If you bust a drug dealer, there's no less drug dealing, right? Everyone knows that. Someone goes on the corner the next day, obviously. But even more importantly, what she noticed is the murder rate actually goes up. And she couldn't really figure this out until she looked into it. And what she found is the best way to explain it is, if you or me go up to your local liquor store and we try to rob the beer or the vodka, they'll just call the cops and the cops will take us away.
Right.
So that liquor store doesn't need to be violent or intimidating. If we go up to your local weed dealer or your local coke dealer and try to steal their product, obviously they can't call the cops. The cops would arrest them. So they have to be, under system of prohibition, they have to be violent and intimidating. They have to, and obviously they don't want to be having a fight every day, so they have to establish a reputation for being so violent and intimidating that you wouldn't dare to screw with them. You wouldn't dare to take them on. So and they, of course, have to establish control of their patch by violence. The Nobel Prize-winning economist Milton Friedman calculated there are 10,000 additional murders every year in the United States, which are, you know, rival drug gangs killing each other and people getting caught in the crossfire. I tell the story in the book of a little girl in Baltimore who was just playing on her stoop who got caught in the crossfire.
Right.
That happens all the time.
All the time.
So Lee Maddox notices that, and she kind of notices, I came into this to bankrupt drug gangs, but actually, I'm the one keeping them in business. This whole system of the drug war is what keeps them in business. The alternative is to have drugs sold not by armed criminal gangs, but the people who used to sell them before the drug war began, the people who sell them in Switzerland today or provide them in Switzerland today, pharmacists and doctors, right? Pharmacists and doctors don't shoot anyone in the face, right? And then Lee, one of her best friends, a cop, a very brave cop called Ed Totley, was working undercover. He goes to do an undercover drugs bust, and the dealer just shot him in the head. So
right.
Lee had lost her two best friends to this policy, and Lee just couldn't carry on anymore. And she quit, and she retrained as a lawyer, and she now spends her time trying to repeal the convictions of people who are busted in the drug war. She's a really amazing person, Lee. And I think you can learn a lot about that story. And actually, some of the best advocates for ending the drug war are part of the group that Lee's a member of, the Law Enforcement Against Prohibition,
right.
LEAP. I really recommend people check them out. They're an amazing group.
They've been on the show a great deal.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Aren't they just fantastic?
But this is. I want to thank you so much for the work you've done, and that you put so much into this, and had these interviews from across the globe, including the city from which we broadcast, and told the story of Billie Holiday in the midst of it all, which is just, I think, was so key as an anchor.
Can I tell you one thing in case I forget?
Sure.
Harry Anslinger, when he was making the case for the drug war, said there was one place that proved if you fought the drug war hard enough and you crack down tough as you possibly can, drugs would disappear and drug gangs would disappear. He said it was the city that proved the drug war works. That city was Baltimore. How's that working out for you?
That's a great way to end this.
Right. And another vindication of Harry Anslinger.
Amen to that. Johann Hari, the book is amazing. Chasing the Scream, The First and Last Days of the War on Drugs. You can also go to chasingthestream.org, scream.org, excuse me, which I recommend.
.com.
Thank you. .com. Johann, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much for reading the book so carefully and so deeply. I massively appreciate it. Thank you, Mark.
I appreciate the book.
Cheers.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our intern and Dan History research producer is Sienna Greaves. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. On our way out of here, we're hearing Rock and Roll Suicide by David Bowie. On this day in 1970, David and Angela Bowie were married. To podcast The Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.
Wait so patiently on your song. You walk past the cafe, but you don't eat when you've lived too long. Oh, no, 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 you're a rock and roll suicide.